Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. Got a big show this week. We're going to skip the usual jocular intro and jump right into it. First up, we're going to speak with Greg Sargent. He writes the Plumline blog at the Washington Post. He's the author of a new book titled Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. Then we're going to be joined by Elizabeth Rogers. She's a former judge, and we're going to talk about potential reforms to the Supreme Court. This is a topic that I'll be discussing more in the next couple of weeks as well. And finally, we'll be speaking with Hannah Dershowitz. Hannah is an old friend of mine and a longtime civil rights advocate. And she testified in favor of marijuana legalization at the New York State Assembly this week. We're going to talk to her about that. So again, we're going to just jump right into the show. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then come right back. Back. You know, I'm really surprised that my next guest hasn't been on the show before. I honestly thought he had, but alas, this is his first go around. Greg Sargent has been a top-notch analyst of the Trump era. He writes the Plumline at the Washington Post, and he's the author of a new book. It's titled Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics, because everybody puts a really long subtitle on their book. Greg, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
In the name of transparency, let me just say that I have not read the entire book. I started it. I have done some skimming ahead, and what I've read so far is refreshingly clear-eyed. I'm looking forward to finishing it. It's interesting that you went with a new Civil War metaphor, given how popular that notion is on the kind of fringes of the right now. I kind of saw that as an acknowledgement of what we face with the modern conservative movement under Donald Trump. How do you define Thunderdome politics? This is a term you use throughout the book.
Well, Thunderdome politics, you've seen the movie, right? Two men enter, one man leaves. And Thunderdome politics is meant to refer to two things. First is kind of the zero-sum struggle that results, the kind of fight to the death that results in a politics in which norms and rules and you know, basic standards of behavior have essentially gone out the window. And the second is the kind of level of crude blood sport entertainment that Trump has dragged us all down to. It has a Thunderdome quality to it. So that's what Thunderdome politics is. It's the intertwining of those two things.
On the first one, it strikes me, and I've written about this for The Nation, that the right has really embraced the emerging Democratic majority thesis. That is the idea that demographic shifts will give Democrats an opportunity to build a sustainable governing majority. It's controversial on the left, but it seems that insulating themselves from Democratic accountability through extreme gerrymandering, voter suppression, et cetera, is the whole Republican game right now. And we're seeing it in their midterm strategy really clearly. Have the media failed our democracy by reverting to kind of normal political reporting as if we're just playing a partisan game?
Yeah, I think there's no question that there's basically an institutional failure of sorts there in that. And just to talk about the Republican strategy of I guess, finding a reverse action against the emerging Democratic majority thesis, one almost doesn't even have to say one way or the other whether he or she supports that thesis to make that observation, right? I mean,
yes.
We know from evidence that Republicans, at least in some cases, it's hard to prove that this is kind of concerted, as I wrote in the book, but we know in some cases that some of these tactics emerged in explicitly in response to the demographic threat that was represented by Obama's victory. I document specific examples in the book where voter suppression laws and tactics that were put in place were admitted to be a response to that. Now, I want to stress that we don't have any kind of real evidence that this is concerted, but it sure adds up to a lot when you look at it.
I think that's an important point because it doesn't need to be concerted, right? It started, we've had John Judis and Roy Teixeira, the authors of the book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, on the show. And, you know, this was something that was much hyped, much discussed for years in the early aughts. So I'm not sure that you need to have a conspiracy theory to say that they've internalized this robust discussion that we've had about it.
Right. I think that makes a lot of sense. And to your point about the media's failure on this, I really do agree. And I think that we need to keep kind of prodding major media figures to reckon forthrightly with what we're dealing with here. And there's this sort of constant reflexive falling back into a kind of coverage tone. And this is hard to quantify. It's hard to sort of show in a concerted way, but we all know it when we see it. There's a
yes.
kind of tone which essentially says, you know, this is just conventional politics. It's two sides, you know, duking it out and on roughly equal terms. Both sides are bad. Both sides take liberties. But, you know, only one side is really actively working, at least in some cases, to prevent participation in democracy for the very reasons that you're talking about. And that just doesn't seem to really come through clearly, I think, in the general overall tenor of the coverage of a lot of this stuff.
And I think that they have also failed in the other aspect of how you define Thunderdome, the kind of blood sport entertainment. And we just had a good example. The other day, your colleague, Glenn Kessler, the Washington Post fact checker, he gave the entire industry, including himself, which is very honest of him, three Pinocchios for failing to accurately report on the results of Elizabeth Warren's DNA test. And the thing that I find striking about that whole brouhaha last week is, and it's a good example of how the press normalizes Trump. So there was a lot of criticism directed at Warren, who clearly is trying to avoid a he said, she said situation with regard to Trump's Pocahontas nonsense as she prepares to run in 2020. And yet there was very little criticism offered for Trump, who's been launching unhinged, like, racist attacks against Native Americans since they started competing with him in the casino business in the early 1990s. So it's just,
right.
You know, we reduced this to this kind of, you know, Trump played Warren narrative when it's really outrageous that this guy is, you know, just this blatant Native American bigotry is on display, and they're not calling him out for it. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Greg Sargent, the excellent Washington Post plumline blogger and author of Uncivil War. So how do we take back our democracy in the age of Trump, given that we're navigating in this environment?
Can I just amplify the point you made a little bit there? Because I think it's really important, and I want to push it to a larger kind of context.
Yes.
You know, that whole failing, that whole imbalance is really way more pervasive than just evidenced in the coverage of the Warren thing, although that is a perfect example of it. Here you have major news organizations writing articles about, you know, the Democrats' internal debates about whether to, quote unquote, go low or whether to embrace Avenatiism, which is something that a lot of glib Twitter reporters use on Twitter. I think it's a kind of a misnomer, but basically what is missing from this discussion is why Democrats might be tempted to, quote unquote, go low. We're having this whole conversation about incivility with a huge gaping hole at the very center of it. And in that hole should be the fundamental fact that Trump has spent 18 months stoking civil conflict on every conceivable front, racial, gender, you know, nonstop provocations that are not just him being crazy or shooting off his mouth. They are deliberate. They are designed to polarize the electorate. They are designed to enrage the left and enrage millions and millions of people who do not support him, because that gets his supporters going. And to be talking about Democrats going low in response to, quote unquote, insults by Trump, which is the phrase the New York Times absurdly used the other day, as if he's just insulting people and we're just trying to decide whether or not to have a snap fight in the high school cafeteria.
Right, like he's not locking up babies in cages.
Yeah, and then there's the deliberate, I mean, it has been reported that Trump thought that the family separations and the locking up of children would play to his base. It has actually been established by reporting. It has also been established that when Trump attacks the football players, he also thinks that's going to make his base happy. And let's just be clear, right? He's attacking the football players not for protesting the national anthem, right? But rather for protesting systemic racism and police brutality. That is why he's attacking them. And so to have the New York Times tell us, well, the Democrats are, you know, sinking to Trump's level of insults, just completely whitewashes what's actually going on here. And it's just,
yes,
outrageous.
It does.
It's just awful.
It is awful. And I mean, whitewash is a good word. I called out a Politico piece the other day by Rachel Bade, which talked about how Republicans could narrowly maintain their House majority.
Right.
And it never mentioned voter suppression. The whole 1,100 word piece just never mentioned anything that's going on in state after state. Brian Kemp basically presiding over his own election and purging, you know, tens of thousands of voters. It's just, it is crazy. So you
can
do.
Can I just add? Can I add something
yeah.
there?
With yeah, of course.
With the obvious approval of the President of the United States. Right. I mean, he has, to an unprecedented degree, used the bully pulpit to tell his supporters that the political system, that if the political system renders victories for the other side, it'll be illegitimate.
Yes.
He said that. He said it before the election. He said it after. He set up an entire sham commission that was designed to find that conclusion. It was unable to and fell apart. But the very fact that he set it up, as you point out, right, you know, none of this stuff, I mean, this stuff is not properly registered in the coverage, and nor is Trump's active stoking of civil conflict and anger and rage registered properly, I don't think. It's not enough for the coverage to say, there he goes being crazy again at a rally, and oh, he is a racist. You have to point out the motive. You have to point out the explicit tactic of fomenting as much civil conflict as possible, and they won't do that. And to your point about the Politico piece, the broader problem here seems to be that that in a sort of institutional and broad sense, the press just isn't conveying accurately the reality of this political party and what's happened to it.
Greg, you know, it's terrible that we've run out of time, but we've run out of time. I need to have you back on soon to continue this discussion.
Yeah, this is good stuff.
Honestly, I didn't block out enough time for this. It's really important. Let me finish the book and have you back on in a couple of weeks. And let's continue this because I have a bunch of questions about, you know, how we have to deal with this. And I've run out of time to ask them. I want to thank you so much.
As often, you know, I would love to talk about it. Let me have you on.
I'm serious. Let's have you back in the next few weeks. Let me just finish the book and let's finish this conversation because I got a lot more to talk to you about. Greg, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week, and we're going to have you on real soon.
Okay, sounds good. And you got everything you need there?
I do. Folks, the book is called Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. Check it out. I really recommend it. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Elizabeth Rogers.
En mi vida, aunque llueva, debo ir a trabajar. No hablaré de este sacrificio. Por ahora me quiero divertir. Vístete con algo diferente. Pronto pasaré por ti. Mienten, mienten los que dicen que este mundo.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. So I'm writing a big thumb sucker for the nation about potential avenues for Supreme Court reform. And I figured that I would have a judge on the show, actually a former justice of the peace. I'm very happy to welcome Elizabeth Rogers to the show. She's also the host of Humorless Rants, which is an excellent podcast, which I highly recommend. Elizabeth, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. So, okay, my thinking is that we are actually in a very interesting moment in that Republican overreach has opened up a whole discourse on the left. For many years, the right would call into question the very legitimacy of the court, the very legitimacy of the idea of five unelected justices who are insulated from public opinion with lifetime gigs overturning democratically enacted laws. And for by and large, progressives would criticize specific rulings, but not question the very fundamental legitimacy of this situation. That's changed. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in a new era. And it seems like there is an enormous amount of talk about packing the court. That is, adding two justices. I spoke with an advocate this week who referred to it as unsteeling the court. What is your view on court packing?
I've actually been of the mindset that we've needed to expand the court for a while now. A couple of years ago, I even did a thread on Twitter about it, and everybody was like, oh, but what about FDR? What about FDR? And it's like, yeah, that was a different time. There is a very good argument to make that we need to expand the court because, one, they're not taking enough cases. And part of the reason they're not taking enough cases is because there's not enough justices. And another reason to do it is simply we need to kind of get with the times. We have a nation of over 320 million people, and we have 9 individuals, that's it, who make final call on whether or not something's constitutional. It slows down the system. It reduces the amount of cases that they hear. They only hear about 200 cases a year. It used to be, especially in the 1800s, they would hear thousands of cases. In fact, actually, for the first 100 years of the court, they had to ride circuit. So they had to run all over the country and actually hear cases. It would also give an opening for more. It may give a chance for us to get more trial court experienced judges. I don't like the idea of just getting all of them from Harvard, from Yale, from elite institutions. Some of our best jurists have come from schools that were out west. Harry Blackmun, one of the justices that I revere because, I mean, he was the one who took on the task of writing Roe v. Wade, which, while I can see some of the issues with the legal reasoning behind it, the fact is that it's a very well-crafted decision that lays everything out. And he didn't go to an elite school. He went to some school in the Midwest, and he turned out to be a fine justice. So I think we should expand the court to have additional members. We should expand it at least by 2, if not by 4. And that's so they take more cases because, you know, the Supreme Court is pretty open in how it actually handles things. It doesn't have to all have all 9 of them decide a case or all 11 if we expand it by 2 or 13. And the reason I think it should be expanded by an odd number is so that way we have a tiebreaker. And I think that that would be a good thing for this country because we'd have more cases, we'd have a better developed case law, and we wouldn't have so much of a lottery for somebody to actually get a case heard. So I think packing the court is not the way I view it. I view it as simply expanding the court to reflect the needs of the current populace of the United States.
So there is the argument that, you know, it will elicit a backlash. I think that one problem with that argument is that, you know, backlash is the sum total of conservative politics at this point. You know, the idea that it will spark a backlash on the right is belied by the fact that, you know, Barack Obama's moderate expansion of healthcare sparked a massive backlash on the right. However, having said that, I do think that it is something that we should be conscious of, because the ultimate arbiters of whether a reform is greeted as a reform or a naked power grab in some ways comes down to the Chris Salizas of the world, you know, the kind of ostensibly neutral pundits and how they receive things. Let me ask you this. So are there alternatives that you see to packing the court that would achieve what we want to achieve, which is creating balance on the court? But also there's another angle here, which is that, you know, it used to be that progressives, if you go back to the 20s and 30s during the Lochner court, it was progressives who argued that black robe tyrants, you know, shouldn't be legislating from the bench. That critique, that analysis was co-opted by the right during the middle of the last century when we had the Warren Court, and it was a progressive court for a brief while, I should say. And I wonder if we shouldn't be thinking about going after the basic premise of a court of 9 or 11 or 13 or whatever, the anti-majoritarian aspect of them having the ability to overrule democratically enacted legislature. That was a long, sprawling question, but do you want to address it?
So the first part of it, the reason why the Lochner Court was considered so horrible by progressives is they kept enacting statutes and enacting statutes and enacting statutes, and then they would constantly be struck down. These were not reinterpretations of existing laws. These were, the Lochner era was the judges had a view of how the United States should work, and the public's view of how the United States should work were completely out of step with each other. And so the justices were imposing their view by striking down statutes that were either democratically enacted through the state legislature or enacted through popular referendum and stuff like that. So that's a big reason why progressives really didn't like that. And that's one of the reasons why they wound up doing end runs around the Supreme Court by adding constitutional amendments. Right. I honestly think we need to stop just depending on the court. We need to start focusing on, we need to get things like the Equal Rights Amendment attached to the U.S. the U.S. Constitution. We need to focus on getting campaign finance. We need to get that attached to the United States Constitution. We need to do stuff like that. We need to be focusing more on doing it is harder work, honestly, to get that attached, because then that can't be taken away by the 9 judges or the 11 judges or anything like that. So on one hand, we need to be doing stuff like that. On the other hand, just because jurists interpret something one way in one court doesn't mean another court won't interpret it in a completely different way just like 10, 20 years later. Brown v. Board of Education was a complete reversal of a prior case. I think it was Plessy v. Ferguson.
Plessy versus Ferguson, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a complete reversal from that, and that was just simply because the people on the court changed. They had a different mindset. They had a different way of thinking. Earl Warren came from California. His mindset was completely different than somebody who grew up, say, in the South. So you have that kind of change occur naturally. So on one hand, yes, push for the progressive justices that we can get. On the other hand, just focus on getting constitutional amendments and strong statutes that they can't reverse. I was rereading Shelby Coe v. Holder, and part of what I noticed that Roberts claimed.
Let me just interject for listeners who don't follow everything so closely. That was the case that gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2014.
Yeah, and Roberts, very weaselly, in my opinion, but this is the way he is, he said, well, you didn't update the documentation to show the support for the restrictions that you required. So you didn't do that, because they had hearings, they had a ton of evidence showing that the Voting Rights Act was still desperately needed.
Yes.
Because of the fact that this happened. But he found this one tiny area that they did not have any hearings or any additional information. You would think that based off of the broadness of everything that they brought forward, and this is Republicans who did this, by the way. This was not Democrats doing this. This was a Republican reenactment of the Voting Rights Act that passed, I think, 99-0. I mean, these were overwhelming majorities, and this was when the Republicans were in charge. They did their due diligence. They did do the research, and they showed, based off the hearings, based off all the evidence that was presented to the congressional record, that yes, this is still a problem, and yes, we still need to have this act. But they didn't do this like one section, and that's what he hung his hat on and said, well, we have to invalidate all of this because you didn't update these particular things. You based it off of stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s rather than basing off of it something now. And it's like, well, we can't base it off of something now because this law has been in effect and has been working. So, I mean, it's like...
I honestly don't understand the rationale in that it's almost like he was saying that there should be an expiration date. I mean, there are sunset clauses in certain legislation. There was no sunset clause in the Voting Rights Act. I've never really gotten my head around how he even justified it, even though it's clear to me that the intent was to insulate conservatives from popular opinion, right? So mm-hmm. basically validating all of these voter suppression schemes that we're seeing really turned up to 11 this midterm. But let me go back to my earlier question. So there is a school of thought that says, look, the fundamental problem is not the people who are deciding these things. The fundamental problem is the anti-majoritarian nature of the court. And in order to address that root problem, we need to think outside the box. We need to think beyond packing the court so it is advantageous to us. And it is risky because it means that we don't have the court to do things that we like it to do, like legalizing same-sex marriage, for example. Mm-hmm. You have to go to the people and make a persuasive democratic case if you were to, say, strip jurisdiction from the court, is my point.
I don't agree with that, because at some point you have to have somebody. Rights should not be subject to public will.
I agree with that entirely. No, I agree with that entirely. What I'm saying is that if we were to question the legitimacy of five justices who are insulated from public opinion, who have lifetime appointments, overturning laws that we like, there is a risk inherent in that they would mm-hmm. no longer have the power to overturn laws we don't like, or you know what I'm
exactly.
saying, or mm-hmm. confer rights that we don't like. It's a difficult trade-off, because this is a very anti-majoritarian institution. The Republicans do have a structural advantage in the Senate, which has an advice and consent duty to confirm judges. And it seems to me that we're in kind of a conundrum, in that I think that on the one hand, I would like to see something known as departmentalism kind of prevail, which means that, you know, we acknowledge that the three branches of government are co-equal. Mm-hmm. There is no judicial supremacy in the Constitution. Marbury versus Madison, the ruling which ultimately led to judicial review, never spells out specifically that the Supreme Court has the right to strike down legislation. So, I mean, on the one hand, I almost think let's do that. Let a Democratic president with a Democratic Congress say, John Marshall has, you know, issued his ruling, now let him enforce it. Let's take some of that power away from these nine people. On the other hand, there is risk for the very reason that you're saying, because, you know, the court is a bulwark against infringements on various civil liberties. It's a pickle.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think it's going to be something that's going to be solved anytime soon, because it was a pickle back in the days of Marbury v. Madison. I mean, the problem is always going to be that in any court case, there's always going to be a loser and there's always going to be a winner. And we want it to have it where the winners are expansion of rights, where people have access to justice, where they have the ability to marry as they wish, where they have the ability to have free association with those that they want to have association with, where corporations don't restrict people's personal freedoms like they are now, and how Kavanaugh would be ruling. He wants to do that. He wants corporations to restrict your freedom. So it's a problem that has been ongoing since the beginning of the country. And I do think that with judicial review, it does have that benefit that something that is incredibly horrible, like, for instance, I believe South Carolina, they're trying to pass a law where Jewish people cannot adopt. And if that is the case, that's a horrible thing to do. We want the government, we want the federal courts to say that's completely inappropriate, and if necessary, pass federal legislation. We should not have to pass a constitutional amendment to say that's stupid and discriminatory and terrible, and South Carolina, you're horrible. We shouldn't have to do that. But what we should be able to do is to rely on the court to say those things of, this is inappropriate, this will never be okay, stop it. You know, so I don't know what the solution is for the second part you were talking about.
I do know that
there are some things that we can do right now to kind of limit what the court can do. If we can get the Equal Rights Amendment passed first, we could probably push that issue before the court and say, look, there's no time limits in the Constitution because there aren't. So the artificial limits put on by Congress don't matter. This should be, in fact, enacted. And that would actually make it a lot more difficult for the Supreme Court to restrict rights for women, for pregnant women, for transgendered individuals. It would make things a little bit more equal. But then we would have to do the same thing with Citizens United, which I think we could probably do. But I'll have to do a whole other segment on
Citizens United. One thought that I've had, so getting back to, this is a concept known as jurisdiction stripping, and there's nothing unconstitutional about it.
No.
It has been done in different times, and you just basically pass a law, you say the courts can't review this. And so one way around this conundrum, a potential way that I'm considering for this piece that I'm writing, is to say that, you know, they... the Supreme Court can rule on state laws and not overrule the other branches of the federal government. That's one thought that I had. Another thing that I would just like to point out to everybody is that the Constitution says that judges are federal judges have lifetime appointments during periods of good behavior or whatever the exact language is. And I would just like to note that it does not say that they have the right to a lifetime appointment on a specific court. So you could fairly easily, I think, statutorily create term limits for the Supreme Court if you then rotate them back to a district court. Anything wrong with that?
I would think that's a good thing simply because, again, remember what I said about trial court judges?
Yep.
Supreme Court jurists, I think we have at least 4, if not 5, who've never tried a case as a judge. And that's
it's like a Supreme Court mechanic who doesn't know how to change your battery or your spark plugs or something.
You know, your perception of how a case should be handled at the appellate level does in fact change based off of the type of court cases you've handled as a trial judge. It's one thing to just simply review paperwork and also maybe hear from the attorneys. It's another thing to see that person that you're condemning to jail for the rest of their life, sitting there and seeing whether or not they actually have that regret, that they realize what they did was wrong. Or in the case of like the Green River Killer, having the trial judge handle his case, he learned something, I think, from the Green River when the man, one of the victim's parents, actually forgave him in court and the killer broke down crying. I mean, he realized suddenly what he had done was absolutely horrible. So you have something like that, and that, I think, impacts the judge's ability to do their job badly. I think it enhances their ability to actually handle things. That's one of the reasons why Sotomayor has been such a great jurist, because she knows what it's like to condemn
in
a person
to prison. So you're saying that when you preside over a lower court that deals with criminal cases, etc., you might gain a sense of empathy that is not obvious when you're grown in a test tube in the Federalist Society's basement.
Exactly.
Elizabeth Rogers, we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. And I can I do one more plug for my podcast?
Please do, yes.
It's Humorless Rants. We are on Podbean, we're on Stitcher, we're on Apple, and we are selling T-shirts on Teespring.
Wow. It's
called Humorless Halloween, and they are classy. Absolutely adorable.
They make me curse when I go on the show. They make me. They force me to curse.
We do.
Yeah, they do. All right, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
So young, just begun. Don't need to live to know what I'll become. When you wake up, still in your makeup, you make it home just fine without breaking.
oblivious to what the trigger does. Will you wake up? Never gonna make up. Got ammunition on a mission, gonna shoot you down. Champion wearing golden gloves, got you punch drunk, seeing stars, little birdie singing.
Why'd you fall so hard?
I don't need to make amends, but I'm done going undercover. I just wanna find a friend. I don't need another.
Welcome back, I'm still Joshua Holland. So my next guest breaks a record for this show. My previous guest, who I have known longer than anyone else, is Jerry Quigley, the radio host out in L.A., who I've known since I was, I think, 14 or 15. But my next guest I've known since, I believe, I was 9 years old. Hannah, is that right? 9 years old?
I think that's got to be about right. And since you're 2 days younger than I,
that's
I'll
right.
Ask
you are old. I am young.
I am
and you
old.
Are
you
old.
Can respect your elders. And I have to say that I am beyond honored to be on your show because now that your listeners know how long I've known you, they will imagine that I'm an early scout of your immense talent.
Oh,
and obviously, to your fans, anyone who's listened to you, I'm sure, you are a remarkably incisive, witty, and warm person. So I'm going to go with I am thrilled to be able to share some talk with you on this.
It's good that we're doing radio because I'm blushing deeply. And I let me say that the admiration is mutual. Hannah Dershowitz is my next guest, who I'm speaking to now. And she is a veteran civil rights lawyer, a hotshot lawyer. I think we should be in some sort of utopia at this point. She's been working on these issues for 30 years. And she testified this week at the New York State Assembly in favor of marijuana legalization. And by the way, let me also say, just for full disclosure, as I usually do when we cover this topic, that I own a small stake in a Oregon-based cannabis company.
Are you impressed? I will not hold it against you.
Okay, very good. All right, so set the scene for us, because I've never testified before a legislative body. So you went up there to do what? Set the scene for us, Hannah.
So it's an interesting scene because this is the first time I've ever, it's the first time I've publicly testified before a legislative body about marijuana tax and regulate, where there has not been one innuendo, snicker, comment about, who brought the marijuana for this. You know, and it was not a serious topic. When I was coming up and becoming a lawyer and wanted to work on this issue, it wasn't a credible professional path. It wasn't something that there were, lawyers working and doing really important work on. Now, the landscape is amazing. What's happening is you've got this incredible innovation going on across states. It's going fairly unchecked in the way that it's supposed to operate. And New York State, a lot of us might not remember, took a really, really big leadership role in rolling back prohibition in the 1930s. So actually in 1923, 10 years before officially prohibition was repealed, New York was the first to reject the federal government's commandeering of local forces to try to get them to help with enforcement of prohibition federally. And
I did not know that history. So was that basically the equivalent of where local resistance to ICE is? In other words, they didn't challenge the law itself, but they refused to work with the federal authorities to enforce federal laws.
I think you're talking about like the policies where there were literally the federal government was asking local authorities to turn over ICE arrest records of individuals who they suspected might be
it was called
non-citizens,
the Secure Communities Act.
And yeah, cities stood up and said no to that. This is a little bit different because, and it actually brings up sort of an interesting part of what gets talked about when people wonder about the federal versus state aspects of marijuana regulation. There's a concept, a doctrine called positive conflict, and it looks at whether there's an actual conflict between federal and state law. So when you have a prohibition, say, on alcohol, if the federal government says alcohol is illegal, then they can go anywhere and arrest somebody for using alcohol. But they can't require New York State police to go and arrest people for something just because it's on the federal books. So if New York State wants to remove that, now where it gets a little more complicated, right, is when there's a positive licensure scheme, right, that is a little bit more complex about how that interacts with federal law and whether it's contravening some clear intent of federal law. But when you have the federal government saying, we don't want people smoking marijuana, and when you have the state saying, well, that's fine, you can come on in and, you know, arrest anybody you want, but we don't have to enforce that, that's a very clear line, and there is absolutely nothing the federal government can do to commandeer the state in that way. That said, you know, there's a little bit of a status issue about, you know, when there's maybe not a direct positive conflict, but the feds could still come in theoretically, not that they have the budget and not that the judges in those courts would be happy if they started showing up with, you know, piddly marijuana prosecutions in states around the country.
I mean, DEA has done raids, though, high-profile raids in states.
High-profile raids, right, but they're not going to start taking over the state's role in arresting individuals who consume marijuana around the state. And so there's no way that they could credibly interfere with New York State's decision not to do that.
How many states are we up to with recreational at this point?
We've got 9 and the District of Columbia, although Vermont and D.C. don't have positive statutes on their books authorizing sales and regulating a market. So actually one of the points that I made in my testimony to the New York Assembly is that we would be the first state to legislatively do the complex work that it takes to craft that kind of regulatory framework for a cannabis market. And that's been done in all the other states that have done it through
the referendum
process, correct. And so this could give New York another way to take some leadership, because I wish that New York would have been the first state like it was in 1923.
I mean, we all want New York to act like a big blue state that it is. And this has been one of the reasons that a lot of us progressives have been incredibly frustrated with the Independent Democratic Caucus, these turncoat Democrats who are elected as Democrats and then empower the Republicans in the Senate. So I think in theory, we've seen Andrew Cuomo reverse his own position on this. He set up a commission and they found that we should indeed legalize in New York. That was conveniently timed to his primary challenge from the left, from Cynthia Nixon, as a lot of his good things are. Let's just be honest about that. But I do applaud
a natural and reasoned shift. I don't mind if someone shifts to a good position by listening to good people.
Yeah,
good
and
arguments.
I don't mind if he does it. I don't mind if they do it out of cynical political reasons, as long as they get there. So, and one of the arguments that he made, which is very hard to dispute, is that Massachusetts is going. I mean, they're actually very far along the process. They've legalized, they're setting up markets. They've been delayed. In fact, I believe they were supposed to have stores opening last June, and then it was going to be like September. I don't know where we're at with that. I think we're very, very close. And then New Jersey is signaling that they're headed in that direction, as is Connecticut. So his argument was really simple. We're going to be surrounded by legal weed states, and it would be idiotic for us to give up those tax revenues.
What about the state and local tax exemption loss? I mean, don't we have another reason to sort of be a leader. And, you know, again, that 23 position that New York took was mostly for financial reasons. They said, yeah, if you want to pay for this, great. We're not spending our money. So
you're referring
let's make
to the
financial
to the caps.
Decisions.
You're referring Pardon? To the ta- you're referring to the caps on state and local taxes in the GOP tax scam, right?
I am, and I'm just wondering if that could be a separate motivator that would resonate with some legislators to, you know, untether a little bit from the feds on this issue.
I mean, I think that it has persuaded some Republicans in certain states to come out on the right side of marijuana legalization. What kind of dog do you have? I haven't met your dog.
I am so sorry. It's a poodle.
A
poodle. He's a poodle, and he doesn't usually make noise, but I think he has a lot to say about marijuana legalization.
Well, we all do. All right, so I guess we should just talk a little bit about your testimony. What was the central crux of your argument?
Well, I mean, it was a pretty thorough analysis of the legislation and the rationales. But I was representing the New York City Bar Association, and I'm on the Drugs and the Law Committee. I also am on the Mass Incarceration Task Force of the Bar Association. But we drafted a supportive position both for the particular MRTA that's out there now, but also for the general policy position of
What's
tax
MRTA?
And regulate. So the city bar can now advocate for any vehicle, and it got passed through the entire city bar. We went to every committee that was related, and we got a position from the city bar.
What does it stand for, MRTA?
Pardon? I'm sorry, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, the
okay.
Kruger and Peoples-Stokes bill.
The bill.
Okay. So the crux of the position that the bar took is that first of all the marijuana prohibition in this state has been a disastrous policy, obviously, from the start, and that it is really the right policy choice for to adopt a tax and regulate position where we, instead of paying all this money for prosecution and court time and jail space and all of that stuff, we instead shift away from giving the positive aspects of the marijuana market to criminals and instead transfer that money to the state and plow it back into the communities that have been harmed by this. And that's actually the crux of the testimony that the bar gave. It's sort of amazing to me that we're not talking about when or if now in New York. Really, the conversation in the legislature was around how and what needs to happen. And there was an incredibly robust conversation about how to make sure that people who have been impacted by the policies get a fair shake in how we're deciding to reform those policies. So there are some things in
that, because I think it's really important that this is a movement that's kind of going on within the legalization movement saying,
correct.
Look, the communities of color have been impacted disproportionately by prohibition. It's still the case that the vast majority of marijuana arrests in New York are people of color, where research shows that they're no more likely to use drugs. And so there's this movement to say, look, let's make sure that the people who have had their, you know, their lives destroyed in some cases from prohibition get a taste of the profits from this extremely lucrative market. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So there are a couple of provisions that actually we had objected to in an earlier version because they weren't as strong to sort of protect people. We think the city bar thinks that it's very important that people not be foreclosed from involvement in the legal marijuana economy simply because of having certainly drug possession convictions, but also to have the market be open as broadly as possible to to people with criminal justice histories and to people who may have the capacity to have good jobs through this industry. And then there are separate things in the bill that are very important to keep that do a broader kind of reparation, which is to look at how, you know, they take a huge chunk of the profits that come in from the taxes that will come when legalization begins, and put those into the directly devastated communities that have been suffering under prohibition. And so that's another way to help, you know, redress some of these problems. I mean, we absolutely, all of the policies from decriminalizing through looking really carefully at our police practices have not done anything to close the gap in disparate arrests in the state.
Yeah.
It's at least 80% of the people who have been arrested for simple possession have been African American or Latino, and it's not an acceptable impact of this legislation. So
yeah.
We can both eliminate that and provide money to build sustainable and healthy communities that are going to keep more people from using drugs or being in desperate positions where they can only make desperate economic decisions. So we need to shore up those communities.
Now, let me ask you this before I let you go. It seems like there is so much momentum behind legalization. Canada just legalized nationwide.
Yeah.
I believe that at some point the federal government will get its act together and delist marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, we have this kind of weird situation. One thing that I know is that right now there's a glut of marijuana in the Oregon market and shortages in California. They're all linked. I mean, they border each other, but you can't transport between state lines. Do you know if there are efforts to kind of work in interstate compacts? And the reason that I ask is because, again, New York in the next few years may be legal along with Jersey and Massachusetts and Connecticut, et cetera.
You know, I think that's going to get to be that's probably a pretty complex issue. And I don't know that there will be a lot of sort of cross-border compact stuff in the beginning of the innovation on this issue. And I don't know that that's true. I mean, it may be that there are, you know, national actors that can kind of navigate the complex regulatory issues in different states and be multi-state. And obviously that's going to happen some, and there already are some, you know, legal marijuana businesses that work in more than one state. But as far as, I mean, I think one thing to think about in terms of your question about the glut, if the market is regulated all over the place, then those gluts can be corrected for. Those kinds of things can be corrected for pretty easily. Marijuana is such a robust and easy to grow plant. It's, you know, works in different soils. It works indoors. So I don't know that correcting for that kind of market supply issue should be a long-term policy question, but I don't know. Is there something else about
I think that, you know, one thing that people should keep in mind, and certainly legislators, is not creating criminals as an unintended consequence. Because basically, right now, if you grow a pound of weed in Oregon, there is no reason why you should not break the law by throwing it in the trunk of your car and driving down to California. And there are other instances like that where, you know, the point is to eradicate black markets and replace mm-hmm. them with regulated legal markets. There
right.
are other instances where we're encouraging some people to stay in the black market, not through malice, but just through, you know, poor mm-hmm. design. So it's a thought that
yeah.
I have. Hannah Dershowitz,
I think those
I believe
are tweaky. You have
they
to
are
tweak
tweaky.
Them along.
Yeah. And we are in the beginning of a new market, something new. We're ending, you know, 80 years of prohibition or whatever it is. So I understand that there's going to be bumps along the road. Hannah Dershowitz, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and hope to see you soon.
Likewise. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Greg Sargent and Elizabeth Rogers. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show on Podbean, iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever else you get your podcasts. I'd like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Maybe I will check that email account at some point. I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a good week.